Starting now. I'm doing well, Paul. Thank you. Good to talk to you. Well, when I listen to Paul McCartney's When I'm 64 Now, the things that jump to mind are the fact that it was sort of, in some way, Paul sort of came out of the closet. Everybody sort of sensed he had that sort of bouncy thing, and the closest thing he had ever really done to an old time music that was kind of the music of his dad, who was a musician in the 40s and a horn player and also a songwriter. Okay, should I start that again? Where do I start that again? Okay, I'll keep going. It was more than the hint of that was "Good Day Sunshine" on Revolver, but they kind of beatled that one up and modernized and put like Beatle harmonies in the chorus on "Good Day Sunshine." This one they just went straight for the old time feel, and the amazing things about this, listening to the track now, how well recorded it is. Of course, George Martin, was as talented as they were, and so was Geoff Emerick, who was the engineer, and it's an amazing recording. Paul wrote wonderful words for a change, and they seem to take you to, the Isle of Wight and take you to these middle-class Brit families with Vera, Chuck, and Dave. And, boy, if you just said Vera to somebody in 1966, they would go Chuck and Dave back to you. What else can you talk about that song? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, when I talk about that, the refrain, and when I'm 64, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Paul's asking, will you still be around for me in a way? And what's really interesting now is that, and has been basically for his whole career, is that, he's wanted us, all the people that adored him back in 1966 and thought he was the king of the world, he wanted to know back then if they would still be around for him now. And he's, to me, he's still sort of going around and has for his whole career, still trying to, win our love. He still wants to have, top 40 success. He still wants to make hit records. That line to me speaks volumes about who he was then and who he is now, because he still desperately wants, to be loved and to be thought of as relevant. And so he was asking back then in that way, will you still need me, and will you still feed me? Will you still basically love me and as much as you do now, then? No, that's... Well, he, you know, Paul always, how do you say this? Well, I mean, he's always been the music guy. He enjoys making music. To me, he's the grunt of the band. I think at some point there was, you know, the musical grunt. At some point, you know, I think music became a business to the other Beatles, even to Lennon. And to Paul, it's always what he wants to wake up and do. And so he loved playing live because he loved playing. What else would you want to do at night? And why not do it in front of a crowd? And that's what happened with Wings. He started a band that they could just go around and play places and play in small clubs. He certainly missed that after the Beatles, you know, stopped touring in 66 and were incapable of playing live the songs that they were writing at the time. So he sort of, you know, come Wings, he kind of dumbed down his music so he could just play live because he enjoys just picking up, you know, various instruments and playing music. He's got the music in him. In general, well, what was so great about Paul is that you can start in so many places. You could listen to Mother Nature's Son, which is essentially just an acoustic guitar and his voice, and then some instrumentation on top of that, you know, orchestration on top of that. You listen to the guitar part and the attack of the guitar player, and you realize, well, that's the bass player in this band playing that. Not only is it just, you know, a brilliant guitar part, he's the bass player in the band, and he's doing that. He's not the guitar player in this band. And then you listen, you know, to the piano on Martha, My Dear, and again, he's, you know, concocted this, you know, clever little part on the piano, and you're recognizing, wait a second, this is still the bass player in the band. And so he, as a musician, I think, you know, you put him in so many different categories in the 20th century, and the list starts getting awesome in terms of, well, he's probably one of the top five songwriters in the 20th century, arguably top 10 songwriters of the 20th century, arguably top 10 bass players of the 20th century in terms of his creativity and what he brought to rock and roll and in the bass parts. One of the best vocalists in the 20th century, one of the most recognizable voices, and the ability to change his voice from song to song, to go from, you know, Michelle to Oh Darlin, almost unrecognizable in Lady Madonna. So there's that. And the fact that then he could play lead guitar also quite well and appears on a number of Beatles songs doing that. He does an astonishing lead on his first solo album on Maybe I'm Amazed. And he was the bass player for, you know. I think at some point he referred to the fact that after Stu Sutcliffe died, he was lumbered with the bass. And that, oh, I guess I have to do this now. And then he became this incredibly creative bass player. So you just start going down the list of the things that, you know, Paul could do musically. And he's just immensely, immensely talented and immensely creative. Can I say some more too? I mean, I could go on endlessly on just that generalization, but I mean, if you want to pick out things and get specific, that's okay. Well, what was I thinking? Well, I was certainly thinking when it one of the astonishing things that's floating around the internet right now, I mentioned this in an email to you, is this a juggler named Chris Bliss does a three-ball juggling act to the end of Abbey Road. This Paul's suite of Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, and The End. And you're physically watching these three balls keep going up that he's juggling. He's doing it, he's tossing the balls and sort of in time to the varying things and the motions that are happening in the music, whether it's a drum lick or the way the piano is kind of throbbing in Once There Was a Way to Get Back Homeward, that kind of stuff. What you see through Chris Bliss and the balls popping up in the air are the incredible motion that Paul McCartney brought to music. And I guess one of the things that are at the top of my list, each time when I was a kid, I'd hear some kind of a part, like, for instance, Paul would... There's a bass line in Mother Nature's Son. After born a poor young country boy, Mother Nature's Son, there's this little walk-up that goes boom, 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 or boom, 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 boom. And what's amazing is that it doesn't just go, it doesn't just walk up the stairs, it kind of leaps up the stairs. It goes whoom, 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 whoom. There's just this physical movement that he creates to music through the bass, sometimes through the guitar, sometimes through a lead guitar, that's what strikes me about Paul's best music, is that it is alive with motion. And, whether it's the way the guitars, swing across in, Hands Across the Water, you know, Hands Across the Water, Hands Across the Sky. It just, you move with him. So, Lennon did not have so much that. Lennon was just filled with brilliant texture and ploddingly wonderful, you know, chord progressions. But Paul kind of made, you know, kind of tweaked Lennon stuff and gave it that more of a bouncy feel. Now, what was sad was when, you know, they were no longer working together, you know, when left alone, Paul was very much, you know, the Teddy Boy, a kind of a lame McCartney song that appears, that they play a little bit on on Let It Be. Mama, don't worry, your teddy boy's here, taking good care of you. And it's as if Lennon said, I'm not touching that one. I'm not going near this. Paul was always that bouncy thing. And unless John kind of gave it a little tweak, you know, it would appear kind of, you know, fluffy. And that's clearly what happened in the 1970s without John around. And I think without Paul around for John, John had no sense of humor. But that's another story. Oh yeah, well, there are many bass tracks that where Paul is extraordinary and where the song where he, you know, essentially brings out the or creates the entire feel of the track. I mean, you don't have to go much past Taxman right there. He creates the entire feel of that song with the boom 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 boom. And Your Bird Can Sing, another Lennon song. That's not another Lennon song, with Taxman being a Harrison song. And Your Bird Can Sing, I love that bass part. It just never stops moving. And, it was neat to hear in the 1990s when we finally heard the original takes of And Your Bird Can Sing, which had a slightly different melody, and it kind of explained why Paul plays the bass part he plays on this take, because it was sort of the bass part to that, to the old version of it. And so, because it's got a completely different melody that he's playing on the bass in the final take of And Your Bird Can Sing than what we're listening to on there. So it's an amazing bass part, and it seems to have a life of its own. What else? On George Harrison's Old Brown Shoe, every time I would mention that to a bass player friend, it'd just be this smile on their face, you know. It's like, can you play the chords to that so I can try to play the bass part? Paul had so much fun in fills, and he would just be so daring. There'd be a lot of mistakes on Beatle records because he was just so daring with these little fly-ups and fills and triple times. I'm not sure if that's the exact musical way to put it, like 16th notes or something like that. But those are the ones that strike me right away as wonderful bass parts. Did I forget a few that I mentioned to you? Mm-hmm. Yes. No. Yep. The bass part in Rain is wonderful too. A lot of high octave stuff and things. Well, and it's not so much that they always fooled with the sound of the bass, but what started happening in Revolver and that era is he stopped playing the Hofner, which sounded kind of thin. And started using a Fender bass that helped the sound of the bass too. And then Geoff Emerick did record things a little differently than the previous engineer. And miking things a little, putting mics closer to the amps and things like that. And then kind of compressing or limiting them more, but. It was more that Paul changed instruments, I think, that changes the sound of Paul's bass. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, and it's okay to kind of re-go over something I may have dropped in before when I was just rolling. Well, pertaining to Paul's, when you're talking about Paul McCartney's vocal style, what's truly amazing is his range and abilities to make his voice sound slightly different. I love the vocal on Here, There, and Everywhere because of the way he goes in and out of falsetto, and you can't even quite tell when he's in his highest range and when he's in fact in falsetto. I love the ability to go from the soft Paul of that kind of feel and Mother Nature's Son and Blackbird, where his, you know, where he has just this dreamy Beatle voice, and then immediately, but then he can also be the screamer that can sing stuff like Long Tall Sally from the early days and doing Little Richard. I mean, a lot of that came from those Hamburg days of singing rock and roll, and he could do that really, really well. I mean, you learn to be able to duplicate the voices that you love, and that's part of, I think, learning how to sing when you're a kid, is singing like other people, and so he could scream like Little Richard, and I'd say that Beatle whoo came out of that, and Oh Darlin', there is the legend of the Oh Darlin' vocal, where apparently he just walked around screaming for a week so he could blow out his voice so it would sound raspy and stuff, but still, it's an incredibly different sounding voice than, you know, the Mother Nature Sun voice. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, the vocals and the vocal styling, Paul's vocal styling on Lady Madonna, was so odd at the time. That it seemed to fool pretty much everybody when the song came out. I grew up in New York, and the self-proclaimed fifth Beatle, Murray the K, who was a disc jockey, who, you know, always claimed to have the inside, you know, dope on the Beatles, when he first played this record, told us all, the listening audience, that this was in fact Ringo singing the new Beatles song. And when I first heard it, I thought, well, Ringo's really learning how to sing. he's gotten a lot further since, you know, Act Naturally. And then, you know, by the time my ears got tuned to the new song, the new Beatles song, because that was always a new trip, too, because oftentimes you'd hear it once on the radio and you weren't even sure what you were hearing. Strawberry Fields was like that. But by the second listening, it finally became clear that the way he just hopped into the falsetto thing, you know, children at your feet, and now you manage to make ends meet. There is a falsetto thing, but I can't quite come up with it now. But the way he goes into the falsetto thing made you recognize it could only be Paul, and certainly not Ringo. Oh, listen to the music that is in your head. Yeah, hello. And Ringo can't do that. So, but it was fun, and for years and years, you know, I don't think Murray the K ever really had any credibility after that. It was really, that was his Katrina moment, if you want to compare it to George Bush. Nobody paid any attention to Murray the K after that. He was done. He was finished. He also did, I guess, around the same time, Murray brought us, in the first Bee Gees song, New York Mining Disaster, 1941, he got all excited that night and played it as the new Beatles song. And whether he was paid scads of money by somebody to tell the, you know, the New York City listening public that this was the new Beatles song, I'm not sure. So I'm not sure if this was a mistake on Murray's part or a way to pick up $10,000, but he certainly got everybody interested in that song. And it was a wonderful single, but, you know, again, it was around the time he was losing his credibility. He claimed that the first Bee Gees single was the new Beatles song, and that was, he had to apologize for that, I guess, a week later or so. Does that answer your Lady Madonna question? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, when you talk about the John and Paul rivalry and the creativity rivalry that befell them in the 1960s, you have to go back to the original moment where they made that decision that every song they would write would be a Lennon-McCartney song. Now, they had probably written 25 or 30 songs at that point, and they knew how they worked. Very often one of them would, you know, bring to the other two-thirds of a song or even one-third of a song. And I refer to it as like there's sort of the guy, the grunt, and then the tweaker, and one would, you know, tweak the other person's song and make it just a little bit better. One would go, here, I've got a new song, and it kind of goes like this, and then the other would say, well, what if it kind of went like this? And they made each other's songs better, and they knew it. And so they decided that no, even if one contributed a line or a phrase here and there, their names would both be on it 50-50, because that's kind of how they worked. They knew they added that little, you know, thing to each other's songs that made them special. But by the time it was 1964 or 5, and they were now the two coolest songwriters on the face of the earth, and were in this sort of Beatle thing that was changing pop music, they kind of wanted to let everybody know who was doing what, and they kind of, each one wanted to be the one, or at least get the hit, this thing of like, we're all in this together, it wasn't really going that way anymore. And Paul wanted everybody to, I think more in the beginning, John was jealous that, whether it was about Paul's looks, whatever John was jealous about. And listen, John, you know, certainly admits jealousy. One of his greatest songs is, I'm Just a Jealous Guy. So I'm not, you know, talking behind a dead man's back here. He clearly was filled with it. And many of the Beatle books describe their, you know, the jealousy of the different lifestyles during their Beatle years. That John was sort of stuck playing a married, you know, guy with Cynthia, whereas Paul could run around London in the 60s. And John was clearly jealous of that. But as a team, a writing team, what was wonderful, what the dark side of jealousy that I talk about is that one would hear a great song from the other and then go, darn, yike, he's ahead of me. I've got to write something better than that. And so it was that thing, that push and pull thing, that trying to top each other and trying to let the world know I'm the real Beatle. I'm the one that's responsible for all of this. And that's not, you know, a healthy thing to feel, but it did wonderful things for their music, and it stretched them both. It made Paul's much more edgier, and it could make John soft, and it made John sort of softer. Well, if Paul wrote this ballad that was stunning, like Yesterday or And I Love Her, he, you know, John, well, I can do that. I can write a ballad. And he would write If I Fell. Like, I can do anything you can do and do it better. And that was the key, I think, to their success. Once they didn't have that anymore between them, you know, both their music became very sort of flat and one-dimensional. Was that too long? Okay. Okay, good. You know, but one of the things, if you're just talking about the Paul skeptics, because, you know, everybody will look at something and come from a different viewpoint, and this is fair. And it's I was trying to, you know, in preparing for this, you know, this conversation, I was trying to think about the fairest way I could look at it, because I think deep down I'm a Paul lover, and I would go for on Paul's side. But if I had to make it sort of a ballot measure, where in California, where they print on our, you know, on our pamphlets that they send out before elections, they give you the, you know, the pros to both sides. You know what I'm talking about? Right? And that what you have to look at here is that the two entities of John and Paul needed each other so much that you can't really decide, well, he's the one. It's not like it's the Matrix and it's Neo and you're the one, but you know, they were the one. And in order to do something wonderful, you need somebody, you know, to bring in a crummy song for the other person to just go, well, it could go like this. And if I put this little bridge to it, it could go like this. And they needed each other so much that, you can't isolate one from the other. You can certainly make the point that, John had more to say. John took himself much more seriously as an icon of the 20th century. I mean, he bought into that, you know, from 64 or 65 on. I think he really took seriously, Lennon really took seriously, the mantle that was given to him, whether it was the spokesman for the 1960s, whereas Dylan ran away from it, Lennon just completely embraced it. And Yeah, but either way, there, you know, you have that it was true, and I, Lennon backed off that statement, you know, with I think an honest truth. The way he handled that, you know, it's not it's just a concept of Jesus. We're not saying we're better than he is. You know, it's a wonderful quote. But in fact, for me, it was true. They were, you know, my religion back then. And I would, you know, if I was just sitting in a restaurant and I heard I heard a Beatles song in the background there, I was immediately comforted, just like the Bible can comfort, you know, people. If I was just in a strange place and there was just this comforting effect of that's right, the Beatles are out there. They're mine. We are one. But no, Lennon really took the icon thing seriously, and how could, well, and it was true, and, when did I'm trying to think of Lennon songs as, besides, you know, All You Need Is Love, and, where he clearly, you know, and Give Peace. Well, you know, those things that would come later, unfortunately, were I think he was taking himself way too seriously. But the thing that I always look at is the fact that in the 20th century, the three most senseless things are the killing of Gandhi, the killing, you know, whose life was about peace, the killing of Martin Luther King, whose life was about peace, and then the killing of Lenin, whose life was about peace. And I think in the 20th century, he kind of goes in that category. Those are two great guys to be, you know, or great is not necessarily the best way to describe either one of Gandhi or Martin Luther King, but, you know, two incredible figures who did have a lot to say and a lot to add to society. And I think Lennon saw himself, in a way, he saw himself in that world. Well, when you're talking about Paul's, I'm trying to set this up. When you're talking about Paul's solo career and Wings and the Wings years, there are many wonderful songs, and there are my favorites are the ones he seemed to try the least on. When he would, you know, like, oh, I give up, I'm not going to try to do that, I'm just going to stick something here. Some B-sides to singles like Sea Moon, which I may be the flip side to High, High, High. Another flip side called, because why Sea Moon is so lovely is because he's just not trying so hard. There's just this sense of, I'm going to turn on the tape recorder and have fun, you know, overdubbing and screwing around vocally, and it's just a B-side. And there was no sense that it, you know, had to meet the standards of Paul McCartney or the Beatles or anything like that. It was like, oh, let's just screw around with this little piano thing. Another song like that is I'll Give You a Ring, and I'm not sure what that is the flip side of, but I can get back to you on that. But of the standard stuff that's on McCartney, for me, Paul sort of is spotty up until 1976, Venus and Mars, and then it's pathetic from then till now. But and that's many, many years of the big P lighting up on the scoreboard. But the early wonderful Wing songs, my goodness, Junk from the first, from his very first McCartney album, that song Junk, besides Maybe I'm Amazed, Junk gets quite overlooked as a beautiful ballad. Well, the mood is the guitar part, of course, and then in Junk, and then the mood created, and then the musical transition from one part to the other, which Paul did amazingly well, his transitions were always the most exciting things to Beatles songs, is that he would take a song to a different place with either the bridge or going from a 4-4 measure to a 2-4 thing, even if from a verse to verse or something. But let's see, again, in the old time feel songs like The Honey Pie, When I'm 64, Your Mother Should Know, he wrote, You Gave Me the Answer is completely overlooked. That is better than all of them, I think. Just in terms of the feel he creates on the track, I think that's on Venus and Mars. 1985 is a wonderful, No One Ever Left Alive in 1985 Will Ever Do. Again, the piano, it's like it's got a phenomenal piano part. There's power to that song, which is unusual in the Wings years, because he was getting fluffier and fluffier, but that song kind of explodes. The Backseat of My Car, no one ever talks about that song. That's on Ram, and has very much the McCartney sweet thing that's at the end of Abbey Road. There are three or four different melodies that swing through the back seat of my car, and it's a lovely lyric, and it just, each section surprises you. Uncle Albert and Admiral Halsey, which did get a lot of play because I think that was a single, again, is that McCartney motion thing that I think I mentioned it when I was talking about the motion, the way the guitars swing across in the Hands Across the Water part, but there's just so much joy and fun in that song. He didn't care that John was pissed off at him at that point. You know, there was a sense that during Let It Be, you could tell that, you know, he was writing songs just to sort of prove to John that he could sort of write songs that were not fluffy, but like Let It Be, and what else? But at any rate, oh, there are so many moments to talk about. God, you know, and I go and I keep thinking, oh, there's that. If anybody's ever seen that clip of Hey Jude, it's just the most. I get, you know, chills watching it because Lennon is sitting there behind Paul, who's got this adoring haircut. He's playing maybe his greatest melody, and Lennon just looks so pissed off. It's like, how am I going to top this? This is really annoying. And on top of it, it's about my son. He's written a great song about my son. And he's just sort of chewing the, and I'm doing nothing in this song, really, except playing this lame sort of like strum thing. It's just a wonderful moment of you can really sense the, like, how can I do better than this? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, oh boy. I wish you wouldn't have asked me about something in chaos and creation in the backyard. No, it's hard for me to talk about Paul's modern stuff. I fear that when I listen to it, I want more from the art. Than the artist is willing to give me. And I know that whenever I want something or I have a desire for something to be like, it's like when you read a book before you see a movie, you kind of want the movie to be kind of as good as the book. And so you have these preconceptions and your desires, and that does get in the way of watching anything that is an artistic piece unto itself. And so that I have all these yearns that he can, you know, that he will give me another paperback writer, that he will play the bass like he used to play the bass, that he will play the guitar like the way he used to play the guitar, and he just simply doesn't. When I hear his melodies, they seem like he's trying to not write an earlier song that he did write. Sounds like when he wants to play G, C, and D on the thing, he's got to throw in a B flat, not because it works anymore, but because just so it's not an earlier Paul song, and no one will say, oh, he's just copying an early Beatles song. See, he seems to try so hard melodically to stay away from copying himself that he writes these, to me, very unmemorable songs. And what's amazing about the Beatle years is that they're just, all the melodies just seem to flow. There's no fear that he's copying himself. He's continually breaking ground. And I think that ever since my position is 1976, he's been so conscious of not doing, you know, certain melodies or being close to anything he's done before, that he has no freedom as a songwriter anymore. He's trapped in, you know, by his own past. And I guess that's my answer to your question. It's not a pretty one, but I know I have not liked a McCartney album since the mid-1970s, no matter how many times people say, he's back. Did I explain why well enough? Okay. Okay. Yes. Well, certainly the artist that springs to mind who has not become trapped by their past from the 1960s, I think Paul Simon certainly did the best version of that. And I think that, you know, the key will always be in music is that if your tastes change, your songwriting can change. And I don't think Paul's tastes grew. All right, and that to me would be the Paul McCartney's tastes grew, and that would be the to me the one big difference. Whereas Paul Simon and even Joni Mitchell, their styles changed because the stuff that they were listening to, they got, you know, changed. And Paul, I think, stopped listening to other people's music. And that may have happened, I don't know when. I don't want to put a year on that, but I don't think he ever got beyond Beep Bopalula, which was what he always said was his, you know, favorite song. That's the song he would take to a desert island. And on desert island discs, it was Beep Bopalula. Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing that's you know, wonderful about the song, and that sort of makes it a classic song, and he clearly was trying. Okay, one of the things that one of the more interesting things about Here, There, and Everywhere, in which Paul was really trying, I think, to write a classic, was the way he constructed the entire lyric, using the title Here, There, and Everywhere, and taking those words, and beginning each verse with one of those words, here, making each day of the year, that kind of thing. And he just did it so well. That's what's so striking about it, is that, you know, he was just this rocker from, you know, from Liverpool, and is like, oh, you want to do a Brill Building song where the lyric, it's almost Broadway-ish the way it's, you know, constructed. Another thing about the song is the intro is lovely and very 1920s-ish, that, you know, just sort of sets up the entire mood of the song. Lennon had done an intro on If I Fell that was very much like the a song like Bye Bye Blackbird from the 1920s. So those are the things. Yes. Uh-huh. And you can't really hear too many McCartney songs, you know, after those that even attempted that kind of thing. Where I'm going to do a song in this style and stuff like that. Oh, can before you go into that. So the Amish, the textures, just on Here, There, and Everywhere. Okay, I'll try to mark it here. Another thing on Here, There, and Everywhere that's not necessarily from a songwriting point of view, but it's just the sound of it. The stunning background vocals that, from what I understand, that they worked on those first and way the longest too, of John, Paul, George. Doing the oohs and ahs, and just the texture of the sound of it, even now, is just amazing, and was a leap in Beatledom, and would definitely be like the signpost to what would sort of happen, I think, even on Sgt. Pepper, where their ahs were just so completely tight and gorgeous, even Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the oohs and then the three part together. I think Here, There, and the backgrounds on Here, There, and Everywhere kind of are signposts to what would happen on Lennon's Because on Abbey Road, where they completely got it perfectly, and the three voices just blend into this incredible texture that still, you know, is Everly Brothers like in the fact that they're just the sounds of their Liverpool voices, the intonations work so well together. I think so, yeah. No, because you can. It is a leap. I think from the This Boy thing, from because of just the fullness and the richness of the texture. That they were clearly going for texture, and Lennon's voice has got that thickness to it. McCartney doesn't quite have the texture, but. When mixed into John, and he can sound like John, you know, and a lot of times on high harmonies you think it's John singing, but John couldn't reach that part, but it's clearly just Paul, you know, singing like John. When my friends sing with me, they try to sing like me. and that sort of happens when you're doing harmony. Yeah, they were fans of what the Beach Boys were doing too. Yes, and the Beach Boys again have that thing of the brothers, where you have the same textures and the voices of brothers. When I talk, I sound like my brother, my oldest brother, and my middle brother, so that you have that brotherly texture that's really important. And the Beatles somehow had that sense of brothers, you know, because of their accents. Yes, it is, For No One is a beautiful Paul song, but it's also interestingly recorded, by George Martin. There is that wonderful horn part, that drifts through the song where, you know, because he's George Martin, he's possibly the most respected, you know, record producer in all of England. He can just ring up the most respected London Philharmonic horn player and say, could you come on down? And this guy comes on down and plays a part in a song that they've sort of messed with the speed a little bit in terms of speeding up and slowing down. They recorded it not at exactly the right speed. So the guy has to come in, the musician has to come in and play, you know, a little horn part I guess it's a French horn, where he's not exactly in the piano is not exactly tuned to, a symphonic piano. And they do some magic to kind of match it up and stuff with sound and speed and in the recording of it, to make it sound pretty much in the same key. And the amazing thing about George Martin is just when he needed to be simple, he kept it simple. And, you know, when he had to get crazy, he got crazy. Mm-hmm. That B-flat chord in For No One, that was the real shocker. There was this in the mid 1960s. There was the descending C progression, and best displayed in a song by Percy Sledge, "When a Man Loves a Woman." And you know, you start off on C, and you kind of walk down with the bass going to B and A and G and F and stuff. What you don't go to is B flat, and you kind of avoid B flat because it doesn't work with a descending C progression. Well, suddenly Beatle Paul decided, and he effortlessly pops in this B flat in this progression that was a little bit of a jolt at the time. It was like, hey, this guy can do anything he wants. He can make that sound good. That's what I really remember about For No One. It was the B flat in the descending C progression. The day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all the words of kindness. It's, I'm walking away from the mic here. She no longer needs you. That one. Did you get that? Do you want me to do that on mic? All her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. Right there is the B flat. What's do you know the backstory to Eleanor Rigby that they write about in the books, that there is the church that Paul and it's there. It was really spooky to see when I was in Liverpool, and that they weren't aware of it. That Paul has no recollection of it is really weird. Well, my word, in Eleanor Rigby, the string quartet, is so beautiful. The arrangement is, amazing and still, you know, stands up so well. I think Paul, when you really study Paul's vocal on it, it's like when he's singing the vocal that they kept, he seems to be listening to it. He seems to be stunned by it himself. Occasionally he's like a late on a phrase or something because he can't believe what he's singing to. I'm not sure, the core, it was, what was amazing to me when I was a kid is that it was so simple to play on the guitar, and there was only E minor and C really, and little variations of those two things, those two chords. And how easy it was to remember the words. That's how I know when I write a song, if the song's good, if I can remember the words right away, I guess, you know, that's... But if I always forget the words, I get the real... maybe they're not so good if I can't remember them. But with that, with Eleanor Rigby, it's like once you get the first line, and first word in a verse, you just run the whole thing out in the rest of your mind because it's just so beautifully constructed lyric. I know that's not... Your question was more about George Martin. And I don't, it's hard for me to speak to something that's that cool and how the cello parts are, you know, all I can say is wow, you know, I just feel like a kid when I have to talk about the string arrangement to that. There is that wonderful thing on one of the anthology records where they just give you the four track, without the vocal. And it's just amazing to listen to it. I would direct people to see if they could get a hold of that if they haven't heard it. Just by itself, it's amazing. And so well recorded too. No, in Got to Get You Into My Life, what I did recognize recently was how, you know, I always loved the guitar, the sound of the electrics on that, and that would sort of become the, you know, the sound of the electric on the next, on certainly Sgt. Pepper, and at the time they were the coolest sounding guitars I'd ever heard, and I just realized recently that they don't come in until like 2 minutes into a 2.5 minute song, and it's really just the heading towards the coda and the final refrain, these, you know, Harrison things come in and then, and they still sound good 40 years down the line. There are a lot of bands over a lot of years that I think have been affected by the sound of those guitars, and a lot of people still record guitars like that. It's been fun. I hope there are a few sound bites in there without me stumbling and tumbling over my own words.